All right, let's get started. Abayisai, if you have a Mishnah Berurah that came from you, that's great. If not, I would not worry. Let's remember where we were yesterday, and let's jump into today. Yes, we began yesterday by sketching out the fact that we have multiple mitzvahs d'oraisa. At the Seder itself, unfortunately, we have no Korban Pesach, so we have two mitzvahs d'oraisa, the mitzvah of Achilas Matzah and the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. And as well, over the course of all of Pesach, we have the Isser of eating chametz, and we have the Isser of owning chametz, bal yirua, bal yimatze. Chametz is asr b'achila, it's asr b'hana. You can't eat it, you can't have any benefit from it, and you're not even allowed to own it. You're not allowed to own it. We have an Isser against owning it, and we have a mitzvah saseh of tashbisu, to destroy, a positive mitzvah to destroy the chametz on Erev Pesach. So yesterday we began digging into some of the details of that in terms of the way which the Mishnayos and Masechet Pesachim are organized chronologically. So they start with the night of Erev Pesach and run through the first night of Pesach from Leil Yud Daled to Leil Tezvav. So the first topic in the Mishnayos is Bedikas Chametz. We spoke about that yesterday a little bit. It's a Machlokas Rashi in Tosfos, right, on Daf Beis Amud Aleph, whether that's a way of ensuring that you don't own chametz. Sir Bayra Bay Matze, I'm not own chametz, I better check the house to make sure that I don't own the chametz. And so some Rishonim say, others say, no, if I know I have chametz, but I don't have to, why should I have mechliv to go searching? Wherever I have chametz, I get rid of it. But why is there a mitzvah of bedika? So others suggest that the mitzvah, the chi of bedika is because of the Isra Achila. We're worried, Shema Yimsa Gluska Yafa, if you're going to have chametz around the house, so you may, if you end up, even though I didn't know it was there, I thought it was gone. Okay, I didn't go looking. Let's say I'm in that Torah, I didn't go looking. I got rid of whatever I knew about. But then when I find it over a Chol Moed, so maybe the concern is I'm going to end up eating it. It's going to look good. Maybe even a donut that's a few days old looks really good over the course of Pesach. So Shem Yim Tzegluski Yafi, you'll find something delicious, and you'll just start munching. Why, asks Tosfos, should we be more concerned with chametz than with any other treifa food? I'm allowed to have treifa food around the house. I can't have it in the refrigerator unmarked, but I can own a bag of dog food, which is not kosher. Sometimes dog food, as an aside, sometimes dog food is asr b'hana, so that's a real problem. If you have dog food, which is real basr b'chalav, meat and milk cooked together, some dog food is, most is not. There's asr, that's real basr b'chalav, the rice is asr b'hana. So asr b'hana means not that I can't eat it, I can't feed it to my animals either. So in that sense, dog food needs a sort of hashkacha. You have to make sure dog food is not asr b'hana. Most dog food is not. Most dog food is asr b'achila. You wouldn't want to eat it. And even if you would, it tends to be made out of non-kosher ingredients. But I'm allowed to have it around the house. I can have a piece of tray for meat that I'm going to feed to the cat around the house. I'm allowed to keep, as long as it's marked, I can have non-kosher food in the house. So why is chametz different? That we had discussed yesterday, a very beautiful, Tosfos discussed in a beautiful run. Tosfos says, look, chametz, we're used to eating. Orthodox Jews are habituated to not eating treifa food. So if you have a cheeseburger around the house, a little strange to have a cheeseburger around the house, but technically speaking, not an Easter, because I see a cheeseburger, I know it's not for me. I see a bacon, I know that's not for me. But chametz all year long is kosher. One week a year it's treif, so I'm not habituated to not eating it. That's why Shem Yimsev Luzka Yafa, the concern that I may come across some tasty piece of chametz and eat it, it's more of a concern. And then the Ran takes it to the next level. The Ran says, that's not only the concern of the Chachamim, that's a concern of the Kaddish Baruch Hu and the Chumash. The Ran says he thinks, the very fact that there's a din daraisa, you're not allowed to own chametz, what's that all about? Oh, I can't. That's very rare to have an Isra against owning something. You have it a few times, very rare. The Ran says, yeah, that's a siyag daraisa. That's a din daraisa, which itself is a gezerah to another din daraisa. The Torah said, don't own chametz, because we're concerned. If you own chametz, you're going to end up eating the chametz. And we understand why, because of this svar that Tosfos lays out. It's something that's normally kosher, all of a sudden now it's treif. So that's why you have a siyag daraisa, the Ran writes, against owning chametz. As a sidebar, that's a topic that the Yosef Engel and others discuss. This notion that we usually assume that Gzeiros are all Drabanan. Yosef Engel has an article in Lekach, in the Sefer Lekach Tov. Yosef Engel was an incredible Talmud Chacham who lived in Poland in the first half of the 1900s. And he has brilliant, brilliant Sfarim there, dripping with Bekidus. He has a piece in Lekach Tov. He basically says, we may have discussed this earlier in the year at some point, but he says, you know, sometimes people think that Gzeiros are only Drabanan, Siyagim, only Drabanan. Well, that's not true, and let me give you 15 examples. He gives around 10, 15, 20 examples. One after another, after another. Even if you can, you know, you can ask Kashas on some of them, but he's still giving another 10. So one of the most famous examples is this Ram. That Ram believes that Bar Rabbi Matzeh is Daraisa. It's actually an interesting phenomenon. I think the areas where there are the most Gzeiros Drabanan and Minhagim as Siyagim tend to be those areas where you have Siyagim Daraisa. There's probably a Siyag Rashi and Shilti Giborim say the Siyag Daraisa, Tosef HaShabbos is a Siyag Daraisa. And the Kesef Mishnah writes that in terms of Basar B'Chalav, the Isser against producing Basar B'Chalav, to cook Basar B'Chalav together, that's a Siyag Daraisa against eating Basar B'Chalav. The Ran says it's similar by Pesach. To own Chametz is a Siyag to Pesach. It's true by Nida as well. Most Sikrevu is a Siyag Daraisa to actual Gila Arayas. And those areas tend to attract the most Gzeiros Drabanan, Shabbos, Kashrus, Taras, Mishpacha, tend to have, especially among Ashkenazim, the most Minhagim Lahachim as well. The Mesil Sishar quotes Avos Rabbi Nassim and the Vayikra Rabba that the whole notion of Gzeiros Drabanan is modeled after Gzeiros Daraisa. So it stands to reason that not just an overall concept, but specifically those areas that have Gzeiros Daraisa, you would expect to be those areas where you have the most Gzeiros Rabbanan, and those areas you have the most Minhagim Lahachmir, and indeed that's the case. Shabbos, Bas B'Chalav, Taras Mishpacha, and certainly Chametz. There are many Gzeiros Rabbanan Chametz. Ashkenazim especially have many additional Minhagim Lahachmir in terms of avoiding Chametz. We'll talk about some of them very soon. And that may be rooted in the fact that Chametz is one of the areas where HaKadosh Baruch Hu created a Siyag Daraisa, understandably so. So one definite Din Rabbanan, that's the Ran's connection that he's making, is that's why the Chazal saw fit. The same way the Torah says, you're not allowed to own chametz, Gezeri may come to eat it. So the Chacham said, no, you're not supposed to, you know, maintain possession of the chametz you know about. We also want you to actively search the house, ideally the night of Erev Pesach, the night of the 14th, actively search the house. And you have a search, a proactive search and destroy. You search Leil Yedalet, and then you destroy it, which is the Mitzvah D'Oraisa, on the morning of Yedalet. As we started talking yesterday about how B'dikas Chametz works in terms of a Nair, which ideally nowadays would be a flashlight that gives you the most versatility and the most access to places where the Chametz might be. Spoke about the fact that you make a bracha only if you're doing B'dikas Chametz Bizman. You have to do because if you're leaving earlier, you're doing B'dikas Chametz. If you're leaving before Yedalet, you do B'dikas Chametz the last night that you're there. If you have no nighttime option, you do B'dikas Chametz during the day. We always prefer nighttime, even if it's not Yedalet. You only make a bracha if it's Leil Yedalet. And then when we left off yesterday with, and we're going to recap and then jump into this with at greater length right now, is the topic of Mechiras Chametz. We got into Mechiras Chametz actually through the back door. We got to Mechiras Chametz through a discussion of B'dikas Chametz, because the Gemara says that you have the sugya in Daf Gimel Daf Dal, beginning of Masechet Pesachim, that B'dikas Chametz is a chiyuv on whoever has possession of the house when the night of Yudal begins, when the official zman of B'dikas Chametz, Leil Yudal begins, whoever has the house then is the one whoever's holding the bag is the one who's chayiv. What do I mean, whoever has possession, meaning it's whoever owns the house, unless there's a renter. If there's a renter and the renter is in by the time Leil Yudal begins, before Shkia, so then it's the renter's chiyuv. If it's a Jewish renter, then it's the renter's chiyuv. If it's a non-Jewish renter, there is no chiyuv b'dikas chametz. I mean, if I know that I left chametz behind, I know I own chametz in a house that's rented out, so I have to get rid of that chametz. Either I'm going to actively destroy it, or there may be cases if I don't have access to it, then bittul is appropriate. If I have access to it, then I have to get it and physically destroy it. But either way, I don't have a chiyuv b'dikas chametz. If the house is already rented out, I have to make sure I get rid of whatever chametz I know about, but I have no chiyuv to go around actively looking. And if the renter is Jewish, then he has a chiyuv to actively do bdikas chametz. If the renter is non-Jewish, he has no chiyuv bdikas chametz, and neither do I. And that's that din is the basis for the practice of mechiras yud gimel. Doing an early mechiras chametz, which now this year would be Thursday afternoon. If you lease the entire house to Nachri on Thursday afternoon, so that's in his hands. He has no chiyuv bdikas chametz. He's not bound by Barava Matzah. He's not bound by the achilas chametz. He's not bound by bdikas chametz. So if you do early mechiras chametz, so then the house is all the chametz is sold. I don't have to worry about destroying the chametz. And I rented the entire house to him. There's no chiyuv bdikas chametz. And if I'm out of the house in time, I'll do mechiras yud gimel. In a situation where I'm not planning to be in my house at all over the course of Pesach, I'm not going to clean, I'm not going to prepare the house, I'm not going to do bdikas hametz. The cleaning is all preparation for the bdikas hametz, like we spoke about, the Rama. And then I'll do bdikas, I'll be mekayim the din drabanan, bdikas hametz, wherever I am located. You're going to the grandparents, you're going to wherever you're going, you'll be there, leil yudalit, Thursday night, participate in the midst of bdikas hametz on location. And then we spoke about the fact that even if you are going to be home, you can still sell some, most, however much, almost all of your chametz to a nachri. In case you are going to be home, you're doing an on-time mechiras chametz, meaning it's the morning of Yudalot, this year, Friday morning, because you do want to fulfill the mitzvah of bedikas chametz. And the mitzvah of bedikas chametz in a typical situation means you search the entire house. You thoroughly search any place, any room in the house where chametz has been over the course of the year, even if you've since cleaned it. You isolate, and it's, again, as I said, it's search and destroy. So Leil Yudal is a mitzvah of searching, of isolating, locating, isolating all of the chametz. Our homes are not as animal-infested, Baruch Hashem, as was the case with Tekufas Chazal, when they had dirt houses, and you had rodents had a freer reign over their homes. Hopefully we do not have rodents roaming around our homes. They're more concerned about making sure to leave the chametz overnight in a place where the animals wouldn't open your package and re-spread the chametz again. Baruch Hashem, that's not generally not a concern for us in our modern homes. But you isolate the chametz, and then in the morning you destroy it. So in the morning you destroy it, so we do a mechiras chametz on most of our chametz. So that's fine. Everything is, whatever is being sold is already in designated cabinets, and the cabinets have to be sealed, because that's the din. If you have chametzo shel nachri, if I have a chametz of a nachri in a Jewish home, number one, in order for that not to be a problem for me, number one, I can't have any legal responsibility for it, which is part of the nusach of the document of sale between the Rabbanim representing the chametz owners and John Brown, is that we're selling the chametz to him, and he bears full responsibility. We have no legal responsibility for the chametz. Should the chametz be destroyed over the course of Pesach, he can't come to us and say that he can't sue us for the chametz. He probably wouldn't be interested in suing us for the chametz. Even if he would, legally he cannot. So we have no legal responsibility for the chametz, and that's number one. That's taken care of by the Shtar Mechira. The piece that every individual chametz seller needs to know is that the chametz also has to be behind mechitza. In other words, the chametz has to be, which typically means in a cabinet. If it has to be in a cabinet, ideally, obviously, marked off, taped off, so you know that no one's going to accidentally access that chametz. That's not the case for kalim. There is no bal rabbi matzah and chametz dikka kalim. If they're clean, there's no residue, just they have chametz flavor absorbed into them. There is no avera of bal rabbi matzah to own chametz dikka kalim. That's a sugya in Masech Pesachim. And not only that, if you were to sell your kalim to the nachri, not only is it unnecessary, it would also create the problem of tefilas kalim. If you sell your pots and pans to the nachri, and then you buy it back after Pesach, you just bought pots and pans from the nachri, you have to take everything to the mikvah. So that is A, unnecessary, and B, absolutely just going to create a lot of unnecessary chores after Pesach as well. So we do not sell the kalim, and the kalim do not have to be behind mechitza. The kalim certainly have to make sure you don't confuse them. But if you have them inside the brake front is closed, you can see them. That's not a problem. So that's, and Mechiras Chametz, again, is going to take this typical situation, Mechiras Yudalit, a regular on-time Mechira on Yudalit Nisan, going to take place the morning of Erev Pesach. You have your Cheerios, you have your breakfast, and then the Mechiras Chametz takes place right after one's forbidden to eat Chametz. You have the right to eat the Chametz for 4 hours into the day. You have the right to own the Chametz and have Hanav from the Chametz for 5 hours into the day. So the Chametz is sold right after the Zman Achilas Chametz ends. So you're no longer eating it anyhow. And Rabbi Shechter encourages trying to do this. Many posts can do not. Rabbi Shechter encourages trying to do the beer Chametz after the Mechiras Chametz. And that way, the last kazayis of chametz is leaving my property through destruction rather than through sale. So that may be a more ideal fulfillment of tashbisus arm batechem, the mitzvahs asay of actively destroying the chametz. Ideally, you'd want to do it through fire, but this tanam have a discussion. Can you destroy it however you want? You should dafka burn it. So if you can burn it, if it's not snowing and you have the opportunity to burn the chametz, that would be ideal. That's a practical point that I would encourage, making sure that your fire is strong enough before you, that you're not just burning a few pieces of paper, you have actual fire going before you throw the chametz in, so that the chametz will actually get burnt and not just get toasted. But let's talk a little more about how Mechiras Chametz is done, and I would actually invite you, if you'd like, to join me. I every year in Beth Abraham, Rabbi Neuber takes care of the Mechiras Yudalad, because I'm busy. My children and I like to have very involved beer chametz, so we're busy Friday morning. Nubra takes care of the Mechiras chametz, the morning of Yudal, and I take care typically of the Mechiras chametz the afternoon of Yud Gimel. Whoever would like to join me, by all means. It's actually fascinating. Let me explain to you why it's fascinating. I mentioned yesterday, as we were left off, that we do six kinyanim to sell the chametz to the Nechir. Six different kinyanim. That sounds fascinating, and you wonder, like, what's wrong with one? Two? What's with the six kinyanim? So the truth is, it's not that we're just trying to, you know, it's not that we're anxious. It's that we're really not sure which kinyan works. And as a result, we have six different kinyanim, each of which might work, each of which, the likelihood that each one works. So if you're between all six kinyanim, we're pretty certain that at least one of them worked. What's the suffix? Maseches Kiddushin, first pair of Kiddushin in the Bava Basra, plenty of sugyas about kinyanim. We know there are many different ways to do kinyanim and metalplum in particular. So what's the issue? The issue is really, it begins with the machlokas, v'yochon ish lakish and maseches b'choros. The Mishnah tells us in Kiddushin that the way, if you're being kona karka, so if I want to convey ownership of a real estate, I have a piece of land, I have a field, a farm, a factory, an apartment building, a house, whatever it is. So you can convey karka in several different ways. The three ways that the Mishnah mentions are kesef, shtar, and chazaka. You pay for it, pay the purchase price, or you could have a bill of sale that's signed and handed over from the mocher to the lokeach, from the I give you a shtar that says I hereby gift you or sell you my field located at such and such a location, and I give you the shtar, so that makes it yours. Or chazaka, I invite you to act like an owner. I invite you to do something to improve, to enhance the property, and to thereby demonstrate and create the reality that's now yours. You come, you install a lock, you come and you put in a window, even probably attach a hook as a way of showing ownership, it just became yours. How about metalplim? So Mishnah says, metalplim, you call it with meshicha. If you draw it to yourself, I walk into a store to buy a bag of potato chips, and I walk out with a bag of potato chips, now it's mine. Meshicha, hagba. Potato chips are small. For potato chips, you need hagvah. Something that's bigger is harder to lift. So if you drive off with a car, you drive off with a bike, so that was your kinyan meshicha. Now, here's the question. So how am I going to become the chametz? So you have to understand first the following machlokas Rabbi Yochanan and Rish Lakish. Rabbi Yochanan and Rish Lakish is the following debate. Halacha l'maaseh, the way you're kona metalplim is through meshicha. Meshicha hagbah, you take delivery of the item, walk off of the item, and now it's yours. Is that doraisa or is that derabbanan? So that's the machlokas of Yochanan and Rish Lakish. One approach is, yeah, that's a din doraisa. There is a pasuk, Okono miyad amisecha, at the end of Parsha Chumash Vayikra. So the Torah speaks about buying it from someone else's hands. That may be a source in the Chumash for the idea of hagba meshicha, handoff. I give it to you, you pick it up, you walk, you pull it towards yourself, you walk away with it. That's the one possibility is meshicha is daraisa. The other possibility, the Gemara says, is no. Maybe meshicha is not daraisa. Maybe mi daraisa ma'os konos. Maybe in HaTorah, the kinyan on metalklim is also through money. It may not be exactly the same as kesef, the Gemara calls it ma'os, but definitely a similar idea that by paying for something, it becomes yours. In that case, why is it meshicha, which works lamasa? The Gemara says, if you think that min HaTorah ma'os konos, the Chachamim Midrabanan switched over to meshicha because of the concern of dishonest sellers. You're going to pay for something. You haven't gotten delivery yet. Say, I'll deliver it tomorrow. I'll drop it off tomorrow. So if min HaTorah ma'os konos, as soon as you pay for it, it's yours. It's still in my garage. It's in my warehouse, but it's yours. I'm going to come to you tomorrow and say, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry there was a fire, there was a break-in, and, you know, I'm sorry it's gone. It's your loss. Sorry, so sorry. It's your loss, because it may belong to you, Moses Konos. Now, number one, it could be there really was a fire. I'm not really motivated, if I'm not so honest, if Chas V'Sham, the seller is not honest, which is a terrible chet, he may, number one, not be so motivated to save your stuff. Number two, the whole thing may be above Maisa. It could be it just disappeared, and he just pocketed your money. He still has the items. You have no way to prove that it's not destroyed, and you just lost your money. So Chacham realized that with the increases in dishonesty, Ma'os Konos was a very dangerous situation. So that's why if Min HaTorah Ma'os Konos, Midrabanan, Chazal said, no, it's not going to be yours until Mashiach, until you actually have it physically. So at that point, there's no room for any dishonesty. So that's why Lamasa Mashiach works and not Ma'os. The Tanam tell us, if you paid for something, Lamasa, Min HaTorah Midrabanan, there's no kinyan, but it's wrong to back out once you paid. It's even wrong to back out once you gave your word. If you already paid, it's such a severe breaking of your word that the Gemara actually talks about a klala, a misha, instead of misha berach, you give the guy a misha para. That's what it's called. The one, Kadosh Baruch Hu, the one who punished the people of the Ma'abal will punish someone who doesn't keep his word. That's the klala that Beis Din will administer to a guy who backs out after money has changed hands. Give back the money, but it's not right. Anyhow, halacha lamasa. So halacha lamasa, but a kinyan between two Jews, the kinyan that works is meshicha, either min haTorah or min rabbanan. Machlokes Rabbi Yochanan Shlok is whether it's min haTorah or min rabbanan. Why does it matter? L'may nafkamina. Either way, if you do meshicha or hagba, there's a kinyan. If you do maos, it's just a misha par. You get this curse. If you have the right, if you're willing to accept the curse, doesn't seem very smart, then you have the right to back out. So the main nafkamina, whether Mashiach is daraisa, Mashiach is rabbanan, it's because the Gemara, the nafkamina, is from Mechiras Hametz, meaning that the Gemara says in Becharos, that based on a pasuk, whichever is the king that works between a Yehudi and a Nachri, whichever king works between two Yehudim, it's the other one which works between Yehudi and a Nachri. So if you hold that Mashiach works min haTorah, that means the king with a Nachri is Ma'os. If you hold that min haTorah ma'os konos between two Jews, then between a Yehudi and a Nachri, the kinyan is Mashiach. So machlokas, if I walk into a store owned by a Nachri, and I bought a bag of potato chips, I paid for the bag of potato chips, I walked out with it. I bought a Diet Coke, put the money down on the counter, thank you very much, have a wonderful day. We chatted for a minute, and I paid for the Coke, I walked out with it. So it's certainly mine. Right? Either I bought it with the Mashiach, or I bought it with the ma'os. I did both. The problem is, Mechiras Chametz, how you can do both? To pay for it is easy. But the Chametz, remember, if I was a Jewish innkeeper in the 17th century, and I have one big barrel of schnapps, and I'm selling to Nachri, it's not a problem. Give him the barrel, he pays for it, we're done. Right? And I'll come to him after Pesach, and I'll ask him if he wants to buy it back at a profit. I'll offer him 3% profit, 5% profit, whatever it is. I'll buy it back. Sure. Right? Because if it's a single, if it's one batch of chametz, we could do Mashiach, and we could do most. But if I come to John Brown tell him that I'm representing 200 sellers located across several different cities, and the chametz is in 200 different locations. We're not. Moos is easy. Mashiach is not. So if we knew that Moos, if we knew that Mashiach is daraisa between two Yisraelim, and therefore Moos works between Yisrael and Achri, gevaldik. That's Machos v'yachmer shlokish. So king number one is we pay for it. He pays for it. He actually brings a roll of quarters. He actually brings a suitcase of quarters, of rolls of quarters, part of his prep for Mechiras Chametz. Our prep for Mechiras Chametz is to get authorization from all the people who want to sell. John Brown's prep for Mechiras Chametz is to go to the bank and get himself several hundred dollars in rolls of quarters. Why? Because he needs to give, number one, he's going to give me, if I'm representing 200 sellers, let's say, he needs to give me 200 prutas, because we're doing 200 kinyanim at once. He needs to give me one pruta to buy. The chametz is worth more than a pruta, but a pruta already is sufficient as purchase price for the sufficient as kesef kinyan to be kona, take possession of the chametz. So he's going to give me 200 prutas. Right? Willig shows up every year with a word on what's the value of a pruta of silver. Check the value of silver on the afternoon of Yud Gimel. A pruta is, I believe, 40 milligrams of silver. A 25th of a gram, I believe. 25 milligrams or 40 milligrams. So you check what it is. It's usually it's around 2 cents. Sometimes it's 3 cents, sometimes 2 cents. And if it's more than 2 cents, then round it up to three. And then he'll count out quarters. If I say, let's say if it's a year that the pruta is 2 cents, me a pruta is 1.75 cents. They're doing 2 cents per purchase. So say, okay, you have 200 purchasers. I'm going to give you 400 cents, $4. So he'll cut open his row of quarters, and he'll hand me 16 quarters, and that
has to be coins as opposed to dollars.
That's a discussion. So La Mahadrin, Chasam Sofer talks about in Pidyon Abed. It's simpler to go with quarters. Also, it's easier just in terms of the denominations to go with quarters. Because 200 is very neat. But if I was representing 210, so then he would want to just, that he doesn't have to bump up to $5. So that's the first kinyan is kesef. And then the next kinyan, what's the next kinyan? The next kinyan is sudar. Right? Sudar is a kinyan that is actually a very fascinating kinyan that we're getting a note in here. It's 1/40th of a gram. Thank you, Akiva Papras. 1/40th of a gram. So that's 25 milligrams. 25 milligrams of silver. Yeah.
Yeah. Why does it matter? How is this enough kamina? Because either way, there's a zeros or a bond on that. Most doesn't work by itself.
That's only between two Yisraelim. Oh. So whichever one is the one that works minat Torah by Yisraelim, the other one works by Nachrim, bein minat Torah, bein minat Rabban. That zeros line, that's a good question. It's a very good question. That zeros Rabban was only made by between two Yisraelim. So the kinyan number one is kesef. Number two is a kinyan sudar. Right? If I give you a kli as a sort of a formalized type of chalipin, so that's a kinyan that you can use, given that the sudar literally means a handkerchief. I give you a kinyan in return for saying, you're going to take possession of my kli, you take possession of my handkerchief, of my pocket knife, of my thumb drive, whatever it is, in return for which you're mapping to me lots of different things. Kinyan sudar is actually, in many ways, a universal kinyan. You can use it for metaltim, you can use it for karka, you can even use it for abstract things. To create debt, you can create debt, you can take on obligations. If you ever, next time you're at a chasana, if you watch carefully, usually it's only the edim, the Masada Kedushin, the chasana, and the cameraman. But if you pay attention to what's going on in the chasana, there's a lot of halachically fascinating things going on. One of which is, the ksuba is read under the chuppah, but the ksuba is typically signed at the chassid's tish beforehand, and what the edim are signing to is that they just witnessed the chassid obligate himself to all the financial obligations of the ksuba vis-a-vis his wife. His wife isn't there, but the Masada Kedushin, the rabbi who's officiating, will stand in place of the wife and be zocha on behalf of the wife from the husband all of the obligations he's taking on to take care of her mitzvah for many healthy decades going forward. How is that done? With the kinyan sudar. The rabbi takes the handkerchief, or maybe someone, the Adam takes the handkerchief. You give it to the chassan. He takes that sudur in return for which the chalipin. He takes the handkerchief and he returns makna to his wife. He's obligating himself to his wife all the chiyuvik sudur. That's what you do when you if you come along to Mechiras Hametz. So we do the Kinyan Suter there is not the rabbi doesn't buy the Hametz. I'm Jewish too. I'm not interested in knowing Hametz or Pesach any more than you are. But what's happening at the Mechiras Hametz happens with John Brown. What's happening when we say Mechiras Hametz hours in Shul, that's really Minu Shlichus, a Tarsha. You're authorizing the Rav to act on your behalf in you're declaring your intent to sell the Hametz to John Brown and to rent the space where Hametz is located, and you're authorizing the Rabbanim to be your shluchim to take care of those transactions. So you do a kinyan suder with the Rav, the seller, the owner of the Hametz takes the suder in return for which he's giving power of attorney to the Rav. That's a kinyan suder. So that's key number two. We do it with John Brown. He gives me a I take possession of his pocket knife, in return for which, makna to him all the chametz. Again, there's a suffix whether kinyan suder works. Kinyan suder works in all sorts of items, karka, metaltalim, abstract obligations, but whether it works, which people it applies to is a good question. Does it only work between Yisraelim? Does it even work between Yisrael and Nachri? So that's suffix number two. So number one, we do Moos might work. Number two, we do kinyan suder. And, you know, over the pocket knife or whatever kli it is, that might work. Number three, we do a kinyan situmta. We do a handshake. What does the handshake do? Shake on the deal. So that also has legal significance. Right. The Gemara in Bava Basra says that there's a notion of minig hasochrim, that if in a particular industry, a particular line, it's understood that the way that a deal is closed is by doing something, that's commercial custom, so that's chal al pi halacha. Gemara speaks as literally situmta meant that in the days of Chazal, in the wine industry, you would writing the buyer's name on the barrel of wine was the closing. That made it his. So if that's accepted in the industry, so that counts al pi halacha. And that's why, say, in 47th Street, in the diamond industry, particularly among the Hasidim who make up a significant percentage of the diamond industry on that street. So it's understood that if you shake hands in Muslim bracha, the deal is done. There's no backing out. That's the kinyan. So that's al pi din. That's a valid kinyan. That's what you call minig situmta or minig hasochim, commercial custom. Once again, so we shake hands. Tkias kaf. Shaking hands is a classic example of situmta. But the question once again is, is situmta valid between Yisrael and Nachri? That's key number three. Now, so far we have what? We have Moos, paying for it, and the handing over of the kli, the kinyan suder, and the handshake. What else are we going to do? Another thing we're going to do is kinyan shtar. That too, shtar, they may not have, we do a kinyan shtar, and then we also do these kinyanim, all four kinyanim, a second time in order to create two more kinyanim of the chametz itself. Because not only do you do Moos and Suder and Tkias Kaf, the handshake, and Shtar for the chametz itself, we also do all four for to rent the location, the karka, where the chametz is located. So again, Mechiras Yud Gimel, you do the early Mechir, you're the entire house. You're renting out the entire house, there's no chiyuv digas chametz. If it's on your dalid, if you're doing it on time, mechiras chametz, you're not renting the entire house. I want my house. I'm not interested in renting my house to someone else. I'm wanting to use my house. But I am renting those particular parts of the house where the cabinets, where the chametz is located, they're being closed off. They're all in my son, the chametz. I'm leasing that space to John Brown. I'm create the lease using all four kinyanim, Moos, Shtar, Situmta, and Suder. And that gives me two more kinyanim on the chametz. Kinyan chatzer, because now the chametz is going to be located in a space that's his. And so the kinyan chatzer, and that's kinyan number five on the chametz. The kinyan number six on the chametz is kinyan agav. That's a mishnah in the first parak of Kiddushin, says that if I'm selling you karka and metaltalim, let's say I'm selling you my house and my car. I'm moving to a different state. I'm not taking the car with me. So I'm selling my house, I'll sell my car, I'll buy a new car there. Right? I'm moving to Eretz Yisrael, so I'm not taking my car with me. I'm not going to stick the car in the lift. So I'll say at my house, at my car. One deal. So the din is, we can do, even though, let's say we said that typically, Kesef Shtar Chazaka don't work on a car, but if I do Kesef Shtar Chazaka on the house, and the understanding is I'm selling you both, so then I just sold you both. We did, let's say, a Chazaka, you came, we did Chazaka on my house, and so you just come to the house, the king Chazaka, and the car with the king Agav. Agav means, by the way, you put it along with, that you bought the car travels along with the house. You kona the karka, the house of the king in Chazaka, the king Kesef, the king Shtar. You kona thereby automatically kona the car with the king Adam. So that's our sixth kinyan here. We, after we convey the chametz directly to John Brown with Kesef, Shtar, with a handshake, and with Sudar, we then go through those four kinyanim again for leasing the property. And we say that we're thereby bimakir the chametz via chatzer and via agav. Rabbi Willig always points out that John Brown, that's his name, that's the name of the man to whom we've been selling our chametz at this shul and at 20, 30, 40 other shuls in the New York area for years and years and years. He's now retired, but he was a very successful real estate broker. So Rabbi Willig always points out, when we read through the Shtar Mechir in advance, before we go through the Kinyanim, she always points out that Agav is something that's very close to Mr. Brown's heart, because the whole idea of Agav is that real estate is supreme. And as a real estate broker, it's obviously the idea that that's very, very close to his heart. So those are the six Kinyanim of, that's now we return back to where we started. That's why there are six Kinyanim on the Mechiras Chametz, and as I said before, we assume to all, each one of them has a Safek. We're not 100% sure, but it was between Ben Yisrael and Nachri. We're not certain that any one works. Each one of them Safek in Amoraim, or Safek in Rishon, Machronim, but between the six, we're pretty sure that at least one or two will work, and we are confident that our Chametz has been successfully conveyed to the Nachri. I'd love to discuss one more aspect today of the preparation for Pesach. Maybe next time we'll pick up with Pesach itself. Next time Hashem will talk about Karm Pesach and Matzah and so on and so forth. I'd like to speak for a couple of minutes before we end about Kasher and Kalim, just to start the conceptual background and the practical background. And I see the note that we're almost done with time. So let's take a break for a moment. Okay. So let's get started again, and let's talk for a couple minutes about another major aspect of preparing for Pesach, and that is Hagalas Kelim. We begin just with a social or historical observation. When you look at Shulchan Aruch, it's clear that the balance of how we spend our time preparing for Pesach has changed. When you look in Shulchan Aruch, there's a lot. The major preparation for Pesach was kashrut and baking matzah. In terms of, from a chametz perspective, kashrut was a big deal. Cleaning the house for Pesach was a nothing. I think I mentioned yesterday, the Rama writes that it would be appropriate to, like a hidur in your bdikas chametz, instead of just going in cold, you should sweep the house the afternoon before bdikas chametz so to prepare the house for bdika. So that was the extent of the cleaning for chametz. That's a reminder for us. We take for granted how large and comfortable and furniture-filled our homes are. Whether by contemporary standards, one has a large house or a small house, the small houses, b'zman hazeh, are still many steps ahead of the homes that the Rama was thinking of in the 16th century Krakow. So Baruch Hashem, here it is, at the very end of Simon Tuf Lamed Gimel, the last line, Tuf Lamed Gimel, Rama writes, you should sweep the rooms of the house before Bdikas Chametz, and you should, and he reminds us there, and that's an important point, is remember you have to check pockets during Bdikas Chametz. That is important. You have to go through pockets of whatever clothing you might put chametz into. You probably don't put chametz in your shirt pockets. You do put chametz, perhaps, and you might put some stuff once, a granola bar in your jacket pocket, or in your coat pocket, or in your knapsacks. So those are things you absolutely have to go through. Even if they're already cleaned, you have to go through them, stick your hands in, or feel through and make sure there's no chametz remain in all those pockets, as well as all the other nooks and crannies Rechametz might be. Okay, so Bitkufa in an earlier era, they spent very little time cleaning. There wasn't much house to clean for Pesach, but kashering was a major deal for the same reason. Because who could afford, who was buying two an extra set of pots and pans and forks and knives? That's expensive. You kasher. So we do a lot of clean house cleaning, most of us, and we do very little kashering because we often buy instead of kashering. There are definitely things that we kasher, and it's good to understand it both in Lamdas and the Halacha Lamasa. Just the other day in the Bishul Akum Shiur, and the last two Shiur, we had a chance to talk a little bit about the notion of Tom Kicker. Again, the notion which is, according to Gemara, looks for different sources in Pesukim. Most Rishonim assume, L'maskana, this is a Din D'oraisa based on some pasuk or another. But not only am I not allowed to eat a piece of bacon, I'm not allowed to eat a piece of cheeseburger, I'm not allowed to eat on Pesach a piece of chametz, but I'm also not allowed to eat something else that has absorbed that flavor. So if I have a made a chalent and accidentally put in a piece of treif of meat, so I can't eat. The meat itself is treif of meat. That's basar nevela or basar behema tamea. The potato is not basar nevela. The potato is not basar at all. It's not basar behema. The potato is not pork. What's wrong with eating the potato? The answer is no. The potato is infused, has absorbed the flavor of the pork, absorbed the flavor of the ham. So that's ta'am ke'ikr. That's this idea, which is either I say, or maybe just drasha isur bialma, or according to a minority opinion, din drabanan. But either way, it certainly is a din of ta'am ke'ikr. That if the potato has the flavor of ham, so I'm not allowed to eat it the same way. I'm not allowed to eat the ikr, the ham itself. That's true on Pesach also, certainly. And not only is it true when a food, to eat something that it directly absorbed flavor from the treifas, it was in the chalent together, even if it's a step removed. Even if I had the, and a frying pan. I made a ham and eggs in a frying pan and cleaned it out thoroughly. There's no residue left. It's all clean. The surface is all clean. But 3 hours later, I make ratatouille, I make scrambled eggs for lunch, I make kosher salami and eggs for supper in the same pan. So even though there's no residue on the surface from the ham, but the flavor sinks into the pan itself, will absorb a certain degree of the flavor of the ham in the morning, and it's gonna exude that flavor in food going forward. So if I don't succeed in removing extracting all the treif flavor from the pan, I'm going to use the pan later on for salami and eggs. Salami and eggs will be treif because of tom kicker, because it's absorbed a little bit of the flavor of the morning ham. So how do you successfully solve that problem? So ceramic is generally assumed to not be solvable. Ceramic is cheres. Ceramic. Pottery, you can't extract tumma from it. There's no tarba mikra, and independently, you cannot extract treifas from it. So the Torah says, if it becomes tumma, the only thing you do is break it. There's no way to make it tahar again. And in terms from a kosher's perspective, it absorbs treifa flavor. Other than putting it back in the kiln, which may work, Chazaras Kivshonos, that's typically not too practical. And generally, assume that there's not much you can do with cheres, and you're just gonna treifa, if ceramic became your favorite mug became treif, there's not, you don't really have options. But if it's made out of typical kalim, they're made out of metal or made out of wood, made out of plastic, we assume can be kasher. Moshe Feinstein has a chumra for Pesach, we don't kasher plastic for Pesach. All year long you would. Now, how do you kasher? What's the process? What's the procedure? So the Gemara has a rule based on Mishnayos. The Gemara says that the principle is kibola'o kach polta. The way it was bolea, beis, vav, lamed, ayin, the way it absorbed, the way it swallowed the treif, the way the kli swallowed the treif is the way it's going to spit it out. Kach polta, that's the way it's going to be polite. So you use the same method. So that's why, let's talk about three major, in other words, different, if it went in more deeply, you're going to need a more powerful parallel process to bring it out. So let's say if I And if I have a pot that I cooked chametz in with a water medium, so the way you're going to extract the chametz, or the way you're going to extract that whatever the trefa flavor is through hagala. Hagala, hey, gimel, ayin, lamed, hey, means sticking that pot into a larger pot full of boiling hot water. And the same kebolo kach polto. The same way the flavor went in, it's going to come out. Flavor went in through cooking with water in a kli rishon, so it's going to come out. You stick it into the boiling pot, a larger pot of boiling hot water, all the flavor will emerge, and you'll be safe. But if you, let's say, if you have a spit, you have a grill, you have a frying pan that is used with dry heat. So we see dry heat as a higher level, a stronger level of bliya, and therefore hagala will not be sufficient. If it went in through dry heat, it's going to have to come out through dry. That's what we call libun. Libun is a higher level, a stronger level of kashrin. Libun means you raise it. Basically, nowadays it means you put it in the self-cleaning oven. You raise it till probably somewhere around 800, 900 degrees, to the point where the metal begins to glow. At that point, everything is gone. That just incinerates it. So the post can point out, it's actually better than kebolo kach polto. It's not even extracting it. It's just it's sofro b'makom, it's just incinerating. Any blia inside, outside is going to be destroyed. If you look at if you run an oven and self-clean, you look at afterwards, it's usually ash. Everything is just destroyed. Many things don't last in a self-cleaning oven, but something that does, you can put on a self-cleaning oven. That would be the higher level of libun. If something only became treif through cooking, you could do libun if you want to. You could always do a higher level, but you can't do reverse it. If you have something, the frying pan, which would be considered to be dry heat, if it's not being deep fried, so there's a very negligible amount of liquid, or you have a grill that you want to kasher, that requires libun. You can't go lower, kebolo kach polto. The kosherization method has to be at least as strong as the way the bliya went in to begin with. We can even break it down a little bit more. If you have something, let me ask you a question. How do you kasher your sink? You take your sink, you stick it into a pot of boiling hot water? Do you have to fill the sink with water and light a fire underneath and boil it? Do not try that at home. Entertaining videos notwithstanding, do not. There's no, you cannot and you need not do that type of hagal in the sink. How do you do hagal in the sink? Sink, all you do is boil a kettle and then pour it over the sink. Why? Why not take the sink and stick it into a kli rishon? Besides the fact that you can't, you don't need to, because that's not the way the sink, not the way the sink became treif in the first place. The sink wasn't stuck into a pot of spaghetti. The spaghetti was poured into the sink. So the sink was never in a kli rishon. It was never, a kli rishon is the kli that was actually on the fire, the kli that actually was at the heat source. So if you have the ladle that used the wooden ladle that you stuck into the spaghetti pot on the fire or even off the fire, so that ladle was mamish boleya chametz in the kli rishon, in the pot itself. So the only way to kasher that ladle is to stick it into a new kli rishon of boiling hot water that will extract the flavor. But the sink never went into the kli rishon. The kli rishon came to the sink. So that's what you call, you may have drained a pot of spaghetti into the sink. So that's what we call iri kli rishon. It was poured from the kli rishon. The sink never went into the pot, but I poured from the pot into the sink. The sink was becoming a cliché, and it was getting the hot water pouring out of the pot directly onto the sink. So the equivalent kashering, kebolo, kachpolto, is take a new cliché, a new kettle, boil it up, and pour it all over the sink. And that's how you're going to kasher your sink. You're going to want to be careful when you do that, whether you're kashering in the pot or pouring from the pot, from the kettle. You want to make sure you get every spot directly. Because any spot in the sink may have been hit directly by chametz water over the last 12 months. So you have to make sure when you do the kashering that you do it in a methodical way, so you end up covering, splashing, pouring directly onto, over the course of whatever, 10 seconds, 20 seconds it takes you. Usually you start by pouring over the faucet, and then you start from the edges of the sink and you pour you work your way in, into the center there, you cover everything thoroughly. Question?
Yeah. The reason you said that Libam is using dry heat, is that...
Yeah, you know, Libam is dry heat, as much hotter.
Right, let's say we just got some liquid that got really, really hot. Is it...
What do you mean?
Like oil can get really hot.
So if you deep fry an oil.
Say I pour oil into the oven, it's really hot. It's as hot as the oven was when it was cooking the hummus.
Oh, so that you're raising a good question. The question you're raising is something that Moshe Feinstein talks about. Moshe Feinstein is of the opinion, how do you kosher an oven? So if you have a self-clean oven, great. Close it up, self-clean, you're done. But let's say you don't have it. That's your oven, old-school ovens without self-clean. But you know that the oven only goes to 550, to 450, because that's as high as the dial goes. Right? So usually when we do any method of kosher, we do it full strength. In other words, we're doing Hagala at hot water, we're not just going to raise the water to 190 degrees. We're going to raise it all the way to 212. Right? You always go boil it. You do Liban, we go all the way up to 900 degrees. So guys, Rav Moshe Feinstein has a kula, but let's say I know that my oven didn't go higher than a certain temperature, because it can't. So if Moshe is willing to be makel, then you could just turn it up to that top temperature. I don't have to take it 900 degrees. Just take the oven to 550. Turn it up, dial it up to whatever the maximum is. Because I have no... It's not like I have a chashash, maybe once it went higher. It can't go higher. If it's locked in, so the Moshe says, you can just turn it up to the highest and leave it there for a period of time. And that will be sufficient kashrut. That comes up in kashrut chocolate equipment also, not at home. That's an industrial question. Chocolate equipment, the chocolate gets scorched above 120 something degrees. That's a question. Can you just do another round of chocolate to and kosher? Do you really have to take everything up to 212 degrees with water, which is a complicated and delicate chocolate equipment? So that's a question. How broadly would we apply Moshe Feinstein's kula? You know, to say kabol kachpolto in a very, very specific way, not just to pick libun, to pick your multiple choices. Do I need libun hagala or hagala de irui? But like mamre, like to the detail, this degree, that degree, to do it exactly the way it was done before, with Moshe Feinstein's style. That's the question. Well, maisa we make on the ovens. We are making on the ovens. If need be, if you don't have it self clean, you just put it up to the maximum temperature and let it sit there for a while. One or two more things to understand about this. Tosus raises the following question. Tosus wants to know, how does Hagala ever work? I don't understand, Tosus says. How does kashering work? I have a pot. We accidentally made the chalm with a piece of trefa meat. We discover, give out, okay, that obviously chalm goes in the garbage. Or else it would be donated to someone who can use it a nachri is not mechuyav to keep kashrus, right? But I can't, Jews can't eat the chalm. Okay, chalm is off the table. How about the pot? It's the pot you have to kash, okay? So we'll take, let's say it's not a ceramic pot, let's say it's a metal chalm pot. So take the metal chalm pot, we'll clean it out. It has to be thoroughly clean. And then we'll put it into a larger pot of boiling hot water. Tosa says, I understand, how does Hagala work? That's Hagala. How does it work? Right, Tosa says, I understand. The thing with it, they have the tray for blias in the pots, and now we're going to put a big pot of boiling hot water. So the blias are going to come out, kabolo kachpolto, and kapolto kachbolo. I understand, the blias go out into the water, why can't they go back in? What? The blias know, oh, I just left this pot, I can't go back? Maxwell's demon, for those who are holding in modern physics. Oh, what's going on here? So Tosus tries to figure out how does Hagala work? It's going to be going out into the Hagala water and going right back in. Some of it will. So what's the solution? So the solution that we accept is you have to do something to make sure that if it goes back in, it's not going to matter. What does that mean? So either you have so much water, such a large kashering pot, that there's 60 times as much water as there is the volume of the trefa pot. So any blias that go into the water become bottled in all the water. So that's when they're bottled. Now they're They're voided, and we don't care about them anymore. Okay, that's one solution. But that requires, that works if you're kashering a fork. Dr. Gregory, it's going to be hard if you're kashering a pot. Another solution that's sometimes used by kashrus organizations when you need to... The other major solution, I put this, the other major solution is to make sure that the flavor will be ruined, and even if it goes back in, it's not going to matter. What do I mean? What I mean is like this. We said before that tam ke'ikr means not only I can't eat the potato that cooked directly with a tray for meat, but even if the meat flavor goes into the pot, and then later on, later that day, I use the pot again, and it comes out into the broccoli, that's a problem too. However, the Gemara says that in general, if that's true only within 24 hours. But if the flavor of the treif of meat was sitting in the pot, in the pan, the fork, and the spoon for 24 hours or more, it's no longer the same day. It's called eno ben yomo. Ben yomo means it's still within the first 24 hours since it absorbed the flavor. Eno ben yomo means it's raised, the flavor is raised set for more than 24 hours. So the Gemara says if it's an eno ben yomo, that flavor, it's sitting in the charsus akadir, it's sitting in the walls of the pot, and it's going to get a metallic flavor from the spoon, from the pot, from whatever the kli is. And it's going to be, if that flavor, I made ham and eggs Tuesday morning, and Wednesday afternoon, I make kosher salami and eggs in the same pan, if the pan is dirty, there's mamish, actual ham there. But if it's all clean, just a question of the blia, the flavor that was absorbed into the pan. So if that flavor has been sitting for more than 24 hours, we say, yes, there's some sort of flavor going into the salami and eggs on Wednesday afternoon, but that's no same tam lefgam. It's doing more harm than good. It's not making the salami and eggs taste better, it's making it taste worse. Because that ham taste has been ruined by sitting in the walls of the pan for 24 hours. So since the pan is an eno ben yomo, just to be clear, you're not allowed to use the pan. You're mechuyav to kasher. However, if you did use the pan, it won't make a treif. I mean, Rabbi, you're not allowed to use it. We require that you kasher it. That was going to get very confusing. But if you did, then if Eino Ben Yomo is the Isra Heshtamshus, is an Isra Banan to use an Eino Ben Yomo before you kashered it, but it doesn't impact anything else. And that's one of the most common shadows I get. Get a phone call. Someone accidentally used the milk pot with a flesh like this. So the first question is, we were making accidentally used a fleishik spatula making scrambled eggs and cheese, and it was a milchik pan, milchik plate, milchik scrambled eggs and cheese, obviously milchik cheese, fleishik spatula. So the first question you ask is, when was the last time you used that spatula for fleishiks? The last time you used that spatula was more than 24 hours ago. So we say the spatula just absorbed milchiks. We have to deal with the spatula because now it's a mix of milchik and fleishik. We have to kasher it if we can, but it didn't impact anything else. The food is kosher, the pan is kosher, because an eino ben yomo blia, a blia that's more than 24 hours old, is no longer an active blia. Like on the yogurt cups, they say live and active cultures. Blia stopping active after 24 hours, in general. That's what Tosa says. The solution is, the easy solution to kashering is let the pot sit for 24 hours before you kasher it. And that way, when the flavor goes out into the kashering water, it comes back in, that's eino ben yomo. That doesn't matter. So that's why the basic steps of kashering are, number one, clean it thoroughly. Something became treif, you probably want to clean in the kitchen, in the bathroom sink instead of the kitchen sink. Clean it thoroughly. And then, so the surface is clean. Step number two is let it sit for 24 hours. Step number three is we have to figure out what kashering method you're using. But either you're going to be boiling a pot of water you're going to be sticking this into, or you're boiling a kettle of water and you're going to pour the water over this item. So you boil up your water, get it going to a good rolling boil. And then you either dunk it in or pour over, depending on whether you're doing Hagala Bikli Rishon or Ivri Kli Rishon. And then finally, step number five, you have to do this carefully, is that once it's safe to do so, the minig is to end your kashering with a rinse in cold water. That actually Rabbi Ganak once suggested that cold rinse, it's hard to know where the cold rinse comes from. Rabbi Ganak once suggested in a shir that it could be it's the Zecher Mikdash. This week's Parsha Tzav, Torah talks about kashering. Just in time for Shabbos HaGadol. The Torah said that if you have, if you cook a carbon, so the carbon absorbs, the pots, well, the whatever it is, the kelim will absorb the flavor of the carbon, which is wonderful until the carbon becomes noser. Eventually, every carbon has an expiration date, either that night, either the next morning, or the next night. So you eat up all the carbon, you're supposed to eat up the bizarre carbon before it becomes noser. But how about the flavor in the pot? So the Chumash says, you mechayev to kasher, your carbon, your kachem, it's a special mitzvah. It's not just make sure that's mutter, it's actually a mitzvah to kasher the kelim used for the karbanos. And for that mitzvah, there are two parts, is merika and shtifa. So this is parasha. Merika is hot water, and then shtifa and cold water. So Rabbi Ganak suggested it could be that the shtifa that we do is a zeichel mikdash. You're in the middle of, you know, you're knee deep, your sleeves rolled up, you're in the midst of clean for Pesach and kasher for Pesach, and sort of like you feel like you're very detail oriented. All of a sudden, you have this moment, you remember Pesach mikdash, karbanos, zeichel mikdash. Practically speaking, I said mentioned that the kli has to be clean. If the kli isn't clean, it goes into the agalapa, you're just making everything worse. Now you're recirculating the actual residue. That's why some things cannot be kashered because it cannot be fully cleaned. You have something that's very grooved, or it has, let's say, like a lot of niches, or it has like a mesh that can't be properly cleaned. We're not sure that you get every last bit out. You cannot kasher with hagala. What you could do is do libun. Libun, as I mentioned before, destroys the bleus entirely. So you don't actually have to wait 24 hours before you do libun, because you're not taking out, no problem with going back in. You're just destroying the spot. And as a matter of fact, if all you really need to do is Hag'olah, so then there's a weaker type of leaving you can do as a substitute for Hag'olah. In the case we only need Hag'olah, the substitute, is to tell you, Rambam talks about it, is called Libun Kal, a lighter form of Libun, which is basically the temperature, Kash Nisraf, the temperature at which straw would ignite, which is probably the same as paper. More or less around 400 degrees or so, 400, 450 degrees. Is a book. What's that? Fahrenheit 454? No? Book about book burners. The title of the book is The Temperature Which Paper Burns. 451? The Temperature Which Paper Burns. So that's called Libun Kal. If you have something that's just hard to kasher because it's hard to get clean, you can just fire it up instead with a lighter type of firing. I will leave you one final din. One final din. You should know that chametz on Pesach has unique chumras. One of them is that chametz on Pesach is not batal b'mashra. It's certainly the Ashkenazi practice. Chametz on Pesach is not, well, we'll get to Ashkenazi practice in a moment. Chametz on Pesach is not batal b'mashra. In other words, to own a crumb of chametz is fine. You're not mechuyev to check for every last crumb. You're only mechuyev biggest chametz, just on the things which are significant. But to eat even a crumb of chametz is a problem. To swallow a crumb of chametz, or even if a crumb of chametz falls into your food, if it falls in on Pesach, chametz is not batal b'mashar. Before Pesach, it's batal. If it gets mixed before Pesach, it's batal b'shishin. If a crumb of chametz falls into an enormous vat of food on Pesach, it's not batal even be'elef. So that's why, let's say, you're not mechuyev to check your svarim for crumbs, unless you have big chunks of Cheerios in your svarim. But if you didn't check if you have svarim that you ate or brought to the table during the year, you shouldn't bring them to the table on Pesach, because the fact that the little crumb is stuck in between the pages is not a problem by Rabbi Matzah. But if that crumb falls into your food, the food is straight. You're not even going to notice. Another example, Minig Ashkenaz, an application extension of Chametz B'Pesach B'Mashahu is the following. We do not rely, we would not accept the rule of Einu Ben Yomo on Pesach. Rabbi Shechter says that he gets his shayla every year. The husband wanted to be helpful, decided to surprise his wife, let her sleep in and call him on Pesach, and they made her favorite scrambled eggs, and was looking for a spatula, and someone always does this. Not the same person, but invariably someone is going to do this and end up calling with the shayla. Right? He's looking for a spatula, and found the spatula. The problem is the spatula that he found, he opened up one of the chametz sticker drawers and took out a chametz sticker spatula and made eggs in a Pesach sticker pan with Pesach sticker eggs, Pesach sticker cheese, and a chametz sticker spatula on Chol Moed Pesach. He meant well. He meant very well, and he meant His kavana was to do chesed. His kavana was to give his wife a break. Unfortunately, good intentions are one half of the recipe. The other half of the recipe is good implementation. And here we say that your reaction might be what we just said before. Eina ben yomo, right? I shouldn't use a spatula. I'm not allowed to use a spatula. But after all, if this is a kosher home, it's chol moed. So that spatula is not used for chametz in several days. However, Ashkenazim assume that Eina ben yomo does make treif on Pesach. I mean, Eina ben yomo of chametz makes treif on Pesach. We see that as an extension of chametz b'mashal. So in that case, you have to figure out what it was used for. You have to figure out what it was used for. Yes, you have to trace back. If I can trace back that throughout the year we never used it for chametz, then I'll be okay. But remember also, things also get chametz sticked not only by the way they're used, but the way they're washed. Because I may have thrown it in. I may have only used it for eggs and cheese, but then I threw it in the milk sink together with the bowl of Cheerios.
But all that is like removed from the room.
No, because then I turned the hot water, and I...
That's considered to be chametz
managed. Cheerios, floating in Cheerios with hot water, yeah. I think so. That's why we kasher bechers. And we kasher bechers, and you have to kasher the silver kiddush cup for Pesach. Some people, that's all they kasher. Silver kiddush cup. Right? So you kasher silver kiddush cup because you're worried. A, you may not have noticed, but it could be over the course of the year, the one time they end up sticking the chalafel into the wine, the way you were washing it. So we tend to, we're very wary, especially because you're not dealing with one event. You have one event. I accidentally used this for milchiks once. We defined event beer. So over the course of an entire year, when chametz was not on your mind, it's not a milchiks, you're always sensitive to. The chametz thing wasn't on your mind. That's why we tend to assume that things need God. The assumption is that things do need. The things do require kasher. Okay, so those that's the basics of kashering for Pesach. That's the basics of Mechiras Chametz. Thank you all. Adults and BM Cares like for dialing in. The plan to learn over the course of the day. Enjoy the rest of your non-snow day. And hopefully, is it snow? Oh, it's snowing. Okay. I'm not near a window. Last time I checked, there was no snow. In Mitzvah Hashem, we will be able to see each other in person tomorrow. If we have 14 inches of snow on the ground tomorrow morning, maybe we'll be doing this again. Shkoyach chaver. Thank you, Yossi.
How is-